The Tom Woods Show, episode 561.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, a whole lot of Tom Woods Show listeners are now getting cash rebates for the online purchases they make thanks to Ebates, which sends them checks. Plus, they send you $100 if you sign up just 3 people. Check it out through tomwoods.com/ebates. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the last episode of the year. I'll be returning on January 4th, 2015 with episode 562 and a whole new year of episodes. Thanks so much for listening, for supporting the show in various ways, for making those Amazon purchases through tomwoods.com/Amazon. Whatever you've done, spreading the word about the show or just being a loyal listener, I deeply appreciate. At the end of my conversation today, I'm going to talk to you about things you might do that might tide you over between episodes 561 and 562. I've got some good ideas for you, so stay tuned for those. But right now, it's my pleasure to welcome to the show Peter J. Wallison, who is a lawyer and the Arthur F. Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of numerous books, but we're going to be talking today about his book Hidden in Plain Sight, which came out early this year. Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again. Peter Wallison is a frequent contributor to the op-ed pages of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times. He holds his undergraduate degree from Harvard and his law degree from Harvard Law School. I'll be linking to his AEI page at tomwoods.com/561, as well as to this important book, which very helpfully supplements my book Meltdown from 2009, which focused quite a bit of attention on Federal Reserve policy. But of course, that's not the whole story, and Meltdown didn't claim that it was. There was a lot of this material in Meltdown as well. But the point is, when the Fed creates all this additional money, where does it go, and why was so much of it going into housing? And that's really what Peter Wallison's book will help you answer. Why would all this money be attracted to housing? Well, because housing was made artificially attractive as compared to a lot of other things you might spend your money on. So let's turn right now to Peter J. Wallison. Peter, thanks for being here today.
Good to be here, Tom. Thanks for calling.
I just told people about Hidden in Plain Sight, very important book. It's very much in line, as we were saying before we went on, with some of the material that I've written, and it addresses a lot of the common arguments that we hear about the financial crisis, the housing bust, and what really caused it. I want to start off with asking you about a couple of explanations that have been given for the financial crisis and the housing bust that are just not true, but that have seeped into the consciousness of the public to the point where it's hard to dislodge them. The key one is people were being sold mortgage packages that they just didn't understand. They were being scammed by people – you know, by bankers who were tricking them into mortgages that they couldn't afford. And the poor public were put upon by these predatory lenders. And of course, it all came to this bad result. What's wrong with that explanation?
Well, of course, that happened in some cases, probably a limited number of cases. I was on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And one of the things I asked is that, well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about predatory lending causing this problem. Let's have some numbers on this. Why don't you find out how much of these loans were predatory? And of course, they couldn't find out. The answer really is that there was much more predatory borrowing going on than predatory lending. More people were taking out loans that they knew they couldn't afford because they were so cheap, these mortgages were being offered so inexpensively to people that they took them out even though when the mortgages reset so they were going to become more expensive, they couldn't pay them. They hoped that by the time the mortgages reset, they would be able to pay them, but by that time there was a financial crisis, all mortgages had fallen in value, homes had fallen in value, they couldn't refinance the mortgages, and they defaulted. So I think the real answer is that there was much more predatory borrowing going on than predatory lending in the financial crisis.
All right, that's an interesting way to put it. Now, I also want to ask about from the investor side, we hear that investors were dealing with these opaque financial instruments, and they couldn't really know what was in them. And because these instruments were being created, this just goes to show that the market economy yields you crazy investment decisions on the basis of very little knowledge about financial packages and instruments that people don't know anything about, that are very complicated, and that can easily blow up. Is there anything to that?
No, actually, that's completely false. And the reason we know that is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bought the same kinds of instruments. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, of course, are the two major government-backed housing companies, mortgage companies, and they were very large financial institutions and had been doing this for years and years, buying mortgages from the private sector. That was their business. They bought the same mortgage-backed securities. They suffered the same losses, but they knew when they bought those securities exactly the mortgages that were in those securities. They were given tapes that they were able to read and see the quality or lack of quality of those mortgages, and they bought them anyway. And one of the reasons they did that is that housing prices were going up. In part, they probably thought those were good investments, but they also had to buy them because of the fact that they were required by the government to meet a quota of affordable housing loans that that had been imposed on them in 1992 and got tighter and tighter until, you know, the mid to late 2000 years.
All right, let's follow up on that. One argument that critics of yours might make would be that these affordable housing requirements, it's true that Fannie and Freddie had to comply with them, and they may have played some role. But people like you, they'll say, have wildly exaggerated the role that they played. And they'll say there were totally private lenders who were not under nearly this much pressure to engage in affordable housing. And yet they made these crazy housing loans as well. Now, one thing that you can come back with is, well, the Community Reinvestment Act existed, and your application for a merger with another bank or activity of this sort will be evaluated according to how well you live up to the affordable housing standards. But that doesn't seem like it's an overwhelming amount of pressure on banks to make these loans. So how would you answer that? Like Countrywide, for example, what kind of pressures were on them for them to be so heavily involved in these mortgages?
Well, the reason Countrywide was doing it is the reason a lot of other banks were engaged in this, and that is they had a ready customer in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. By 2008, more than half of all mortgages in the United States were subprime or otherwise risky mortgages. Of those, that was actually 31 million mortgages, of those, 76% were on the books of government agencies, principally Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So a Countrywide would make these mortgages because they knew that they could sell them to Fannie and Freddie. And in fact, Countrywide, for 8 years, was either the top or the second largest seller to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The government was creating the demand for these mortgages. And so banks and others were making the mortgages because they knew that Fannie and Freddie would buy them. Now, there's another factor here, too, and that is that because Fannie and Freddie reduced their underwriting standards in order to take these poor quality mortgages to comply with the affordable housing goals, that built an enormous bubble, a housing bubble between 1997 and 2007. Housing prices went up an unprecedented amount, about 10% a year for several of those years. As housing prices went up, many private lenders thought this was a good investment. We could make money if we made these mortgages. Even if we made these mortgages to people who were not quality borrowers, because by the next year, the house would be worth 10% more, and so our risk would be substantially reduced on some of these loans. But the reason there was this bubble was that Fannie and Freddie had reduced underwriting standards. They had formerly only made prime loans. That was up until the affordable housing goals were imposed on them. They had only made prime loans, but after the affordable housing goals were imposed on them, they started to reduce their underwriting standards. And you can see how you could get a bubble from that, because let's assume that you had $10,000 in order to buy a house as a down payment. If the down payment is 10%, then you can buy a $100,000 house. But if Fannie and Freddie said they will now accept 5% as a down payment, you could then buy a $200,000 house. Under those circumstances, of course, there was much more money chasing many houses, and that caused this gigantic bubble over time. So the bubble fooled the private sector to some extent. That's why many of them bought those mortgages. But the engine of this whole system was the government, particularly Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, buying these mortgages in order to comply with the affordable housing goals.
It's funny that in the years that followed, the government and its apologists tried to claim that, of course, it had nothing to do with us. There's no way we could have caused something like this. But at the time and leading up to it, they were all too happy to take the credit for the increase in home ownership. And they said it's because of our policies. And in fact, Andrew Cuomo, after there was some famous discrimination case that had been settled against a bank, he said, now, it's true that in the future, to meet our affordable housing and our fair housing standards, there will be more non-performing mortgages on these portfolios, but that's just the way it is. So he came right out and admitted that. Alan Greenspan, years later, of course, admitted that, yes, of course, there were going to be more risky mortgages made, but we felt like that was a good trade-off to have in exchange for a higher home ownership rate. So these people admitted it at the time, and then when it happens, they all pretend to scratch their heads like they have no idea what went on.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Actually, the only person involved in this whole process who ever said anything in the way of an apology for having these policies was George W. Bush, who in his autobiography said, I was, and this is absolutely true. He said, I was very happy to see the increase in home ownership that was going on. What I didn't realize is all of the risks that we were creating for the economy. And that's the correct story in a sentence.
Well, I have to say, I'm not a big George W. Bush fan, but that's about the most significant admission of, you know, ignorance or wrongdoing that I pretty much ever heard from any president. Normally, it's just you circle the wagons and you defend yourself, and then that's it.
That's right.
But that's at
that's
least
right.
That's
you won't hear any such confession from anyone else who is lower down in the government who was actually making these decisions. They have never apologized for what they did or admitted. God knows the left has been taking the position that any statement about the affordable housing goals is completely wrong. But in fact, that is the answer. The affordable housing goals forced on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in 1992 and continued until 2008 created the financial crisis. That's what the book is about.
But isn't the whole point of these affordable housing requirements, the whole point is to make banks extend loans that they wouldn't have made otherwise? Why wouldn't they have made them otherwise? Because they're bad loans. So, I mean, it seems to me the logic of the thing is so obvious. That's why they want these regulations,
yeah,
is to make the banks do things they don't want to do. Why didn't they want to do them? Because they were stupid decisions.
Exactly. Well, the book contains a lot of the history of all of this. And in just before 1992, there were community activists. The Democrats were in control of, I don't want to make this into a partisan matter because this occurred under both Democratic and Republican administrations. But in 1992, the Democrats were in charge of Congress. And the community activists were going to them and saying, you know, home ownership in the United States has not increased for 30 years. It's still around 64%. And the reason is that these two big government-backed institutions, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are imposing too difficult underwriting standards. They're requiring prime loans, and a lot of low-income people cannot buy homes because of that. That is what stimulated the adoption in 1992 of these affordable housing goals. It was to extend credit to people who didn't have good credit because they were low income and they couldn't afford, we'll say, they couldn't afford mortgages, they couldn't afford down payments on mortgages, and by and large, they didn't have good credit records. That is why the affordable housing goals were imposed on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That was the major mistake. If you wanted to help low-income people, you should have done it in a different way, perhaps some kind of government subsidy directly to those people where the government would take the losses. But instead, what's happened is they created this tremendous system in which banks and others were selling these terrible mortgages to Fannie and Freddie, who were delighted to get them in order to meet Fannie Mae and in order to meet the affordable housing goals. And the machine that was created resulted in the financial crisis.
How do you respond to the common argument that you are blaming this tremendous financial crisis on poor, vulnerable minorities, when the fact is it was rich white guys in investment banks spinning out crazy investment products who were to blame, and they're laughing all the way to the bank? That's what we hear all the time.
The answer to that is that the government that created the demand for those loans by insisting that Fannie and Freddie buy them. Now, the whole purpose of that was to enable more loans to be made to people of low income who were otherwise not able to buy homes. And so the answer is that the plan actually worked. More people who were of low income were able to buy homes because of this system. But the trouble is that people to buy these homes, they created a huge bubble as a result of all of the money that was being poured into the financial system, and when that into the home ownership system, and when that happened, we got this gigantic bubble. Many more mortgages were made that shouldn't have been made as a result of the view that it was not risky to make these very terrible mortgages because home prices were going up. And the result of all of that, unfortunately, was a collapse in 2008 and a financial crisis.
You write in the book about the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Can you tell us what that was and what your role in it was and what the result was?
I was a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Right after the financial crisis occurred, Congress voted to set up to tell the American people and the president and Congress, of course, why we had a financial crisis. And the commission operated for about a year and a half in order to investigate the financial crisis and report on it. Unfortunately, the way it was set up, there were six Democrats and four Republicans on the commission. I was one of the Republicans. And the Democrats were dead set on demonstrating that this was a fault of the private sector, that the government was not involved at all. They wouldn't accept any arguments about the role of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or the role of the affordable housing goals, and produced a report that I think was simply a basis for providing the new excessive regulation that came out from Congress in the form of the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010. So this, unfortunately, was a system that was set up for the purpose, inevitably, of demonstrating that it was the private sector that had created the problem and leaving the government untouched, the government uncriticized for its role in this whole process.
What's wrong with Dodd-Frank, in your view?
Well, I think Dodd-Frank is what is responsible for the very, very slow recovery we have had from the financial crisis.
Wow, okay, that's a strong claim.
Oh, there's absolutely no question on that. This recovery is the slowest we have ever had compared to all other recoveries from recessions in the past or financial crises in the past. And the only thing that is different about this situation from what occurred in the past is simply the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act, which has suppressed the financial system to such an extent that it has been very difficult for small business in particular to borrow money. And without small business, we don't have the engine that usually gets our economy going.
Wow. Okay. Well, I knew it played some role, but what exactly, what's the big deal about it? I mean, there have been a lot of regulations imposed on small business over the years, and one way or another, they surmount them.
Yeah, it's true, but this is really extraordinary. The Dodd-Frank Act is the by far the most substantial regulatory law placed on the financial system since the New Deal. And it is much tougher than almost anything that was adopted in the New Deal, so that it has frozen our financial system in place, so that large banks as well as small banks are not able to operate as inexpensively as they did in the past. The regulations that have been imposed on them are very expensive. And in particular, for small banks, they now have to hire a lot of staff, lawyers and compliance officials and so forth, that they didn't have to hire before in order to operate under these new regulations. And when you do that, you have less money available to make loans to small business, and particularly the startup businesses that really get the economy moving at the lowest level.
I have to ask you a question from about maybe the first third or fourth of your book, because it comes up constantly when generally the left is looking for some kind of deregulation that must account for this, because their view is that the more market activity there is, the more chance for fraud and financial bubbles and whatever. So there must be something. If only the government had more regulatory power and could have cracked some more skulls, we wouldn't have had this problem. And they always settle on, as you well know, the so-called partial repeal of Glass-Steagall. And I know you've written a couple of scholarly articles on this, and then that there's a brief treatment of it here in the book. And it's interesting to note that even the Washington Post had an interesting op-ed piece some years ago saying, look, everybody, quit blaming Glass-Steagall. This is a complete red herring. And I don't know if it was you or somebody else I read who said the only reason Glass-Steagall is even mentioned by anybody is that it's the only so-called deregulation that they can fine that has anything whatsoever to do with any of this. Like, at least it is even in the ballpark of having anything to do with it.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think was the one who said that, and I've said it many, many times. We've had deregulation in our economy. Happily, over many years, we have deregulated transportation. We have deregulated securities. We have deregulated broadcasting. All of these things have given us much lower prices for all of those services and much better services, a lot more innovation as a result of that. The one thing we never deregulated was finance. Now the only law that anyone on the left can point to that could have been seen as deregulation is the so-called Glass-Steagall Act. And that's why it gets mentioned all the time. The only thing that the Glass-Steagall Act did was to allow banks to be affiliated with companies that engage in underwriting and dealing in securities. It did not allow banks themselves to do that. The Glass-Steagall Act is still applicable to banks. They cannot engage in underwriting or dealing in securities, but they were allowed to affiliate with firms that do. And so by mentioning the Glass-Steagall Act, the people who are talking about it have a great advantage in that they can confuse a lot of people into believing there was some sort of major deregulation that caused this problem. But in fact, most of the people who talk about it don't even know what the Glass-Steagall Act did. And the simple way I talk about it is simply to say, if the Glass-Steagall Act had remained in effect exactly as it was before it was changed in 1999, we would have had exactly the same problem, because our problem in 2008 arose out of troubling low-quality mortgages in our financial system and had nothing to do with a deregulation, if you even call it that, of the banking system. The banks, the non-banks that banks were then able to affiliate with, all got into trouble because they bought low-quality mortgages. and held those low-quality mortgages because they didn't realize that they were, in fact, low-quality. If the banks had actually sold them all off, then the banks wouldn't have been in trouble at all. But they didn't. They held on to many of them because they believed they were actually good quality mortgages. And one of the reasons they believed that is that home values were going up 10% a year. And if that's happening, then a mortgage on a home is a pretty good investment.
What about the claim that because of some form of deregulation, these investment banks were able to be much more so-called highly leveraged than they'd been in the past? And this goes to show once again that deregulation leads to highly undesirable outcomes.
This had nothing to do with deregulation. Investment banks were never regulated. So there really wasn't any case for saying that deregulation caused it. The investment banks, organizations like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and even Merrill Lynch were never regulated. The only part of that whole business that was regulated were broker-dealers, which are only the people who buy and sell securities for customers. But the holding companies of these broker-dealers, like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch and so forth, were never regulated. So it's inaccurate to say that there was something in Glass-Steagall that deregulated them. There was absolutely nothing in Glass-Steagall that referred to them or in any other regulation. The problem was simply that the government had created, through its policies, this tremendous bubble that was larger than any housing finance bubble we have ever had in our history. And as housing prices grew about 10% a year, as I said, in the 2000s, people looked at this and said, well, gee, these are wonderful investments, these mortgages, because the next year, a person would have a home that was worth 10% more. And so even if that person defaulted on the mortgage, we would probably be able to recover the value of the loan that was underlying that mortgage. That, of course, didn't happen. And the reason that we had the reason that we had a collapse in 2008 was because we came to a point where homes had become so expensive that people couldn't buy them anymore, and the whole machine stopped running. So people could no longer refinance their homes when they couldn't meet their mortgage obligations and began to default.
Peter, there is so much material in this book that's so great. I mean, it's doing an injustice to your book even to say we've only scratched the surface. We haven't even scratched the surface of this book, especially the last two chapters. Just the subheadings of these chapters. So chapter 13, from bad to chapter 13, interestingly enough, from bad to worse, and the subheading is how government blunders turned a mortgage meltdown into an investor panic and financial crisis. And then chapter 14, the false narrative and the future, why the failure to understand the causes of the crisis may lead to another. I can't urge people strongly enough to check this book out. We're going to link to it at tomwoods.com/561. It's Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis, and why it could happen again. And of course, that's the key point. Hang on the line 1 second after we finish, because I want to ask you a quick question just privately. But Peter Wallison, we really appreciate your time and your very important work.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's really a pleasure to talk with you.
All right, everybody, that is it. But, some things to tell you, some ways you can spend your time when you're weeping over the lack of episodes of The Tom Woods Show. I will tell you that Contra Krugman at ContraKrugman.com, my podcast with Bob Murphy where we refute Paul Krugman every week, will continue. It will continue through Christmas and through the new year. So stay tuned for that. Subscribe to that if you haven't subscribed yet. But first, before the fun suggestions for you, remember, the end of 2015 is the last opportunity you have to become a master member of LibertyClassroom.com before the price goes up $150. A master member at LibertyClassroom.com is a lifetime member who gets every single course in economics, history, philosophy, and all down the line as long as we exist. You get every single course. These are courses you download on demand. You don't have to be in front of your computer or in front of your iPhone or anything at any particular time. You download them, and you got Q&A forums, ask us anything you want. You got reading recommendations if you want to read more and you want to know what's reliable. It's everything you've ever been looking for if you really, really want to become a knowledgeable libertarian. But the Master membership is not only a lifetime membership, it also gives you all of the 400-plus videos that I created for the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum. These are all suitable for adults. I don't talk down to these high schoolers. They're all suitable for you on the history of Western civilization from antiquity to the present, and my course on government, which is really an anti-government course, covers all kinds of tremendous topics. So all that is yours for $150 off, and it's going up January 1st. That's it. There's real scarcity here. You're going to check it on January 1st, and you're going to say, man, why did I procrastinate? So check that out at libertyclassroom.com. All right, so here's some things you can do. I have some people who started blogs and websites recently and used my affiliate link, tomwoods.com/blue. And not only do they get the best pricing Bluehost has, but I also publicize what they're doing, and I send them free tutorials to make them top-notch bloggers, all this great free stuff. Well, there are some ones that I particularly find interesting. For example, now, I'm not really an outdoors person, but that's mainly because lately I haven't had the time to do it, but I could see myself doing it. And here's a site for you to check out if you like the outdoors, DestinationZeroBars.com. I love that. That's a brilliant name. All these .com names have been taken by other people, but that's a really good one. In other words, you want to get to a place where your cell phone is showing zero bars. Then you're really out there roughing it. And the creator of the site says it's a resource site for backpackers and outdoors enthusiasts, helping them get started, find destinations and good foods, get kids involved, etc. So I'm going to put that on today's show notes page, DestinationZeroBars.com. I just dropped my pen, so I'll grab another one. I always got plenty of stuff here, DestinationZeroBars.com. Another one, a great new libertarian blog to check out with a lot of great topics already, MarginallyCorrect.com. And if you just look at the recent posts, we're talking about the Federal Reserve, talking about the Middle East, anarcho-capitalism in one lesson, great stuff at marginallycorrect.com. So you got a little bit of time right now. Why don't you check out these sites that are started by fellow Tom Woods Show listeners? Then a new podcast with a new website, freecitiespodcast.com. And according to the site, our focus is real-life examples of decentralization and market alternatives to problems. You're going to love this because it's looking at micro examples. It's looking at a city here, a little place over here, and how they solve problems that supposedly only government can solve. So that's freecitiespodcast.com. Let's see, what else? What else can I do without totally overwhelming you? Let's see. MichaelFMartin.com. I bet you know that's run by a guy named Michael F. Martin. All right, and again, a great new libertarian blog. Do they want World War III is the top item that I'm seeing now. So obviously a commentary on the Republican debate, but tremendous. Maker's Mark and taxes. Well, I kind of like Maker's Mark, as a matter of fact. But a whole bunch of stuff. Ron Paul is right. Just tremendous. The food police, the surveillance scam, all this stuff covered at MichaelFMartin.com. So I'll link to that as well. So there'll be more coming. There are more of you who have done this. You have to write to me to tell me that you want the publicity, because a lot of times people start a blog, they've only got one post. They don't want publicity yet. That's understandable. So you write to me at TomWoods.com on the contact tab when you're ready, and I'll be glad to give you the publicity. If you're interested in any of these sites, check them out on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/561. I can't give you publicity just for an existing site, because the deal is you got to use my affiliate link to get your hosting. But check that out at tomwoods.com/publicity. If you're interested in starting a site or a blog and you'd like the free goodies that I give you, that's the instructions on how to do it. It's very simple, tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, that's it for 2015. Oh my goodness, I'm tearing up seeing 2015 go, but 2016 is going to be an even better year for me and for the show, and I hope for you guys too. So an early Happy New Year wish to all of you. Again, a big, big thanks for all the support during the year, and I look forward to seeing you once again January 4th, 2016. And as always, thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.